Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast, network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you check out all the other things that 1517 is doing. All the articles, we got videos, we got events, we got all the things. We got the Academy. And so if you haven't just perused the website, I'd encourage you to go over there and do so. We are in 1 Kings. We are in chapter 2. We said goodbye to David in the last episode, so David is officially laid with his fathers, as the book tells us. And now we're going to transition into the reign of Solomon and see how Solomon does with carrying out a few of the things that that his father told him to do, and just how he's going to be different than his father. Solomon is definitely not David 2.0.
No, and it's quite the beginning too. What we got coming up here in 2:13 and following is like 1, 2, 3, 4 different guys that he deals with, and it's not pretty.
Well,
it's quite an ugly start to his reign.
Yeah, in the first little bit of his reign, he does a little bit seem like David 2.0, because some of this stuff you're like, yeah, that sounds like something David would do.
Yeah, but it does, and he's not exactly, but closely carrying out the instructions that his dad mm-hmm. gave him on his deathbed. You know, David was like, deal with this guy and deal with this guy. And then, you know, you're smart. You know how to deal with this guy too. So David dies, and Solomon, we don't know how quickly Solomon carried out some of his father's wishes. But it seems to me, at least judging from the way the story unfolds, that he was waiting for the opportunity. And the opportunity certainly did present itself, at least with an unexpected problem that arose. And that is his older brother, Adonijah. He is not one that David addressed. It wasn't like David said on his deathbed, hey, I want you to take your brother out. He didn't address that situation. But Solomon, taking advantage of an opportunity that Adonijah afforded him, did take his brother out, as we'll see in a second. And then that was like a platform, I guess, for Solomon to engage in these other individuals dealing with them. So anyway, 1 Kings 2:13 starts us out by reintroducing us to the guy that we talked about before from the beginning of 1 Kings, the oldest living son of David, a guy named Adonijah, who was the son of one of David's wives, a woman named Haggith. So Adonijah, if you remember, he's the one who basically had convinced himself that he was going to be king. In fact, so much so that he threw this big party and invited some of his supporters there and a lot of his family except for Solomon. And in the middle of his coronation party, he received the bad news that Solomon instead had been declared to be king. And so all of his supporters take off. Adonijah runs to the altar, grabs a hold of the horns of the altar, and his brother Solomon assures him that all will be well, basically, as long as he behaves. So that was kind of implicit there.
Yeah, he's all right.
Adonijah is about to misbehave.
Yeah, he's all right. He's just on probation.
Yeah, he's kind of on probation. You're like, hey, if you walk the straight and narrow, everything's going to be okay between us, brother. Until, as we'll see, Adonijah made a... Well, it seems like it's a romantic request, but as we'll talk about, it's more political than it is romantic. So Adonijah, the son of Haggith, goes to, not Solomon, he goes to Solomon's mom, Bathsheba. And I love her opening question. She says, do you come peacefully? So, you know, of course, she's not someone that's new to the palace. She's been there for quite a while. And so she knows how these things work. And so you can almost detect in her voice a bit of curiosity, hesitation. So are you coming here in peace, or are you coming here for some other reason? And he says, one word reply, he says, shalom. He says, peacefully. And then he says, I have something to say to you. So she responds, speak. And here's his request. Well, first of all, he makes this claim. He says to Bathsheba, you know that the kingdom was mine and that all Israel fully expected me to reign. Now, that might be a bit of hyperbole there. You know that the kingdom was mine and all Israel fully expected me to reign. Sounds a bit presumptuous on the part of Adonijah. I mean, maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but it certainly wasn't that all Israel fully expected Adonijah to be king, because there were many who did not expect that and did not want that. But I suppose this is his way of basically saying, hey, you know, everything that your son Solomon received really is something that should have been mine. But, you know, that didn't work out. He says, he goes on to say, however, the kingdom has turned about and has become my brother's, for it was his from the Lord. So it's kind of like he's setting things up. He's saying, like, I'm going to remind you that all this stuff should have been mine. And I'm also going to say that, okay, I realize that it was God's will that it didn't become mine. So he's setting things up to hopefully convince Bathsheba, what, to feel sorry for him, maybe, when he's about to make this request, to realize he's lost a lot, and so he's only making one small request, and so on the basis of that, I should honor his petition.
Yeah, he's trying to drum up a little bit of sympathy here. You know, he's saying, look, I mean, and you know, I get the argument, like, hey, I'm the oldest son, I'm sitting here with nothing, and that's not exactly right, but I'm not asking you to, like, I'm gonna play ball. I'm gonna be good. But you know, it'd be nice if you had a little bit of sympathy for the situation I'm in here.
Yeah. And he does go to his brother. He doesn't go to Solomon. He goes through Solomon. He goes through Bathsheba to Solomon for whatever that reason might be. Maybe he thinks that, you know, she's gonna be the one who has the best chance of convincing Solomon to go through with this. Well, what is the request? He says, I have one request to make of you. Do not refuse me. She says, speak. And he said, please ask King Solomon. Doesn't say, please ask my brother. He acknowledges that he's the king. Please ask King Solomon. He will not refuse you. Literally in Hebrew, he won't turn your face away. So he's not going to say no to you. To give me Abishag, the Shunammite, as my wife. And then Bathsheba responds, very well, I will speak. Well, the ESV has, I will speak for you to the king. That preposition that translated there as for could also be translated as about. It's a little bit ambiguous there as to how we render that Hebrew into English. So I will speak for you to the king, or I will speak about you to the king. So a little bit of ambiguity there as to exactly what Bathsheba is going to say to her son, the king. So a bit of a reminder here, who is this woman that he is asking to be his wife? Well, she is the virgin, the beautiful young woman that was chosen to be David's bed warmer back in the very opening of 1 Kings. And we're told that presumably she remained a virgin because David did not have intercourse with her. So, but yeah, she would have remained as part of kind of the harem of the king, I suppose. And so this request is for Adonijah to have her as his wife. Now, the question that's kind of between the lines here is why?
On one hand, it doesn't seem like a huge request, right? On its face, you're like, well, this doesn't seem like that big a deal. This guy's like, hey, man, I'm not going to live in the palace. I'm not going to be king. But I'm crushing on this girl really hard. Like, maybe I could, you know, at least if I'm going to go live in my cottage off to the, you know, across town, maybe at least I could have the wife that I like. That seems like, all right. Like all right. Yeah.
It is a little weird.
It's weird.
You know, but there's a lot of weird stuff in the Bible.
Yeah, this ain't the weirdest thing we've heard.
The woman that was my dad's bed warmer to be my wife. I mean,
well, It's definitely weird.
It's a little freaky.
Not nearly the weirdest thing we've heard.
No.
But yeah, it's a little bit weird. But also, it doesn't seem threatening. I'm like, oh, I see what you're doing here. Like, it doesn't read that way. That ain't the way that Solomon's going to hear it. But initially, I don't know what he's trying to do with this request.
I have a theory that, but I'm going to save it until we get to Solomon's reaction. So I've got a theory as to what's going on here that will possibly, you know, my theory, I think, lines up with the way Solomon interprets his brother's actions. Let me put it that way. And then we have some other examples of this, other biblical examples of the way that Solomon is evidently interpreting his brother's desire for Abishag. But I'm going to save that until we get to Solomon's eruption of anger when Bathsheba comes to him about this.
Well, I think that one of the things that you could say is that this is a bad idea. We don't know how soon this happens. I would assume this happens like relatively quickly. A bad idea, like to go, you're on probation. Like you should probably just like want to chill for like.
Yeah, you should probably just pretty much stay out of everything having to do with the palace for a while.
Right. I do think that there's a little bit, knowing what Absalom did when he got to the palace and he's like, you know, gets all the concubines up on the roof or whatever, and decides that he's got to like be sleeping with the people who slept with the king. It's a power move, and it's to prove some kind of point there that, hey, what was my father's is now mine. Whether that's what he's doing because there's a precedent for that, and I don't know if that's how Solomon interprets it exactly, but I think it's maybe that's what you were going to say. I don't know.
Yeah,
Chad and I have not talked about it.
That's the direction I'm going. I'll explain it more in a minute. But yeah.
But because of all that, whether or not, like, he might just like be like have a huge crush on this girl because she's very beautiful or whatever, and maybe that's clouded his judgment. But what he should be thinking is, well, I can't do that because that will look like maybe I'm trying to possess something that once belonged to the king, and this is like the beginnings of a new coup.
Yeah. So if this was exclusively for romantic reasons, then he certainly should have been thinking more politically than he was romantically, put it that way. So Bathsheba says she'll speak either for him to the king or concerning him to the king. Now, this isn't Bathsheba's first rodeo. She knows palace politics. So I suspect that she has already anticipated how her son is going to react when she makes this request. So that's my suspicion anyway, that's the reason she agrees so readily to do this. So verse 19, that's what she does. Bathsheba goes to King Solomon to speak to him. Well, it says on behalf of again, but this could also be translated as concerning Adonijah. And the king rose to meet her, bowed down to her. He sat on his throne, and he had a seat brought for the king's mother, and she sat on his right. So this is kind of a big formality type deal. There's a king on his throne. There's the king's mother sitting there beside him. And she said, I have one small request to make of you. Do not refuse me. And the king said to her, make your request, my mother, for I will not refuse you. And again, this is kind of formal sounding language here. I'd like to ask you something. Yes, please ask me. Whatever you need, I will take care of it. And then she puts forward the request. She said, let Abishag, the Shunammite, be given to Adonijah, your brother, as his wife. Now, Solomon just said to his mom, make your request because I will not refuse you. And then he turns right around and very vehemently refuses her request.
The idea that a son is not going to refuse his mother seemed to be like the thing that everybody was thinking. And you have to wonder if Bathsheba want this to happen? But it seems more likely that, hey, I'm going to make this request and I'm going to do it sort of earnestly, and then that's going to draw out a certain response from you.
I think Bathsheba knew exactly how her son was going to respond to this. I suspect that both she and her son were going to interpret this particular request of Adonijah the exact same way.
Well, and Bathsheba knows that sometimes it's better to let an idea belong to somebody else. So you can want someone to respond a certain way or to do something. It's always better if you can convince them it was their idea.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening here. Yeah. So she makes a request fully knowing he's going to say no. And she doesn't come and say, Solomon, you will not believe what your brother just asked me to do. No, she just puts forward the request.
Well, she doesn't want to present it in such a way as like, you won't even believe the request that was made of me to make of you. You have to do something. Let me tell you what I think you should do. Because she doesn't want Solomon sitting there, fresh king, to be like, listen, I'm the king. I'll make the decisions here. I'll decide. Like, I don't need you telling me what I'm going to do. No, she's going to be like, here's the request. What do you say, my lord? and let him just fly off the handle.
Yeah, which is what he does. So, verse 22, King Solomon answered his mother, "And why do you ask Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah?" And then listen to this line, "Ask for him the kingdom also, for he's my older brother, and on his side are Abiathar the priest and Joab the son of Zeruiah." So that fell apart rather quickly.
It's a pretty big jump that Solomon makes. He's asking for this woman. Why don't we just give him the whole kingdom? You're like, hold on,
we just give everything to him.
Now.
So let me finish this out, and then we'll go back and talk about what's going on here. King Solomon swore by the Lord, verse 23. So he's serious. He is very serious about this. Swore by the Lord, saying, "God do so to me and more also if this word does not cost Adonijah his life. Now, therefore, as the Lord lives, who has established me and placed me on the throne of David, my father, and who has made me a house, as he promised, Adonijah shall be put to death today." And verse 25, wrapping up this section, says that's what happened. King Solomon sent Benaiah, we're going to encounter him quite a bit in these next few verses. King Solomon sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he struck him down and he died. So that was not a wise request, needless to say. So,
if you're just reading it, it seems like an extreme reaction, right?
Yeah. If you're just kind of reading this and you're thinking, God, man, why did he blow up? His brother just asked if he could have this one girl for his wife. It's not like you're lacking in girls around the palace. I mean, David had a harem. Solomon is going to end up with a vast harem, all these wives, all these concubines. So what's one girl? Well, here's my theory, based upon other biblical stories of what actually is going on here. So if you go all the way back to the book of Genesis, Genesis 35, 22, this is the first time we encounter something like this. This is when you have the story of Jacob and his growing family. And we learn that Jacob's firstborn son, Reuben, lay with his father's concubine or his co-wife, Bilhah. So if you remember that story way back in Genesis, what happened as a result of that is that Reuben lost his right to be the recipient of the blessing of the firstborn. Now, why did he do that? Well, chances are Reuben slept with his father's co-wife or concubine because this was his way of trying to basically claim that he was now the top dog, the leader of the family. So this was not so much of a sexual move as it was a power move on the part of Reuben, trying to say that, yeah, the old man's around, but I'm really the one who's going to be the leader of the family. And he did this by sleeping with, as a sort of a power move, sleeping with his father's concubine, co-wife. Now, as you referenced earlier, Dan, we have another example of this. You've got Absalom, who, as soon as he is successful in his coup, what does he do? He takes his dad's, David's concubines up onto the roof of the palace. He has intercourse with them. Again, not because, you know, this was some sort of sexual, lustful move, but this was a political move. It was calculated to demonstrate via this intercourse that he was now the one who was in charge. He was now the king, no longer his father, David. So we have two occasions earlier in the scriptures where a man without as much authority as another man is trying to basically usurp that authority by sleeping with a concubine or a co-wife who belonged to that man. Both cases, their father. Now, my theory is that that's exactly what's happening here with Adonijah. So Adonijah was not able to be the king that he wanted to be. It was given to his brother. So what he's trying to do is he's trying to take one of his dad's concubines, Abishag, and by marrying her, this will be, as it were, his foot in the door to try and restart his bid to become king in place of his brother Solomon. Now, whether that is exactly what he intended is up for debate. That Solomon interpreted it that way, I think is beyond dispute.
Yeah. Yeah.
That because nothing else explains why Solomon react as violently as he did, so much so that he doesn't just get upset, he kills him. So he basically, by his actions, is saying, listen, it's pretty clear to me that Adonijah wants my throne. He wants me out of kingship, and he wants to take my place. He wants to take the kingdom, basically. And not only that, but he's already got Abiathar the priest and Joab, the son of Zeruiah, on his side, as we've learned earlier. So this is his bid to become the powerful one. So he the lesser, that is to say, Adonijah the lesser, is trying to make a power move to take control by going through, by means of this concubine that belonged to his father David to do so.
Whether or not that's what Adonijah means to do, well, we don't know. It seems like it's an insane move to make. It's so early, just in general. I mean, you're talking about a guy who, when he found out that Solomon was king, was holding on to the horns of the altar, scared to death that Solomon was going to come kill him. And then to turn around and do something like this with that intention just seems crazy. Why would you do that? Unless, of course, so you have two options here. One is that he's so power hungry and upset that he just does something stupid, or he wasn't thinking that way at all and just didn't and was really, really wanted this woman to be his wife and also wasn't thinking and did something really stupid. Either way, he did a really stupid thing, whether that was because he was trying to get power or just because he was too obsessed with this girl and it clouded his judgment. But either way, it was a really dumb move, and a move that doesn't make any sense based on how scared he was that Solomon was going to kill him in the first place.
Either way, romance can be blinding.
Yep.
Ambition can be blinding. It makes people make all sorts of very bad moves, in fact, sometimes fatal decisions. And that's precisely what happened here.
I mean, you can see you can see Solomon being like, oh, this is like the ultimate power move. What he's going to do is he's going to take this girl. Dad couldn't even get himself to pull together enough to sleep with this, young, beautiful woman. And the move that he's going to make is like, the old man couldn't, but I can. It makes sense. It's not going to be like, no way I'm letting you do that.
Yeah, precisely. Well, this was a bad decision. Whatever the motives were, we certainly know the way that Solomon, and I suspect also Bathsheba, interpreted this. And so it all went very poorly for the oldest son of David. And so we end up with the first person dead in this chapter. No more Adonijah, no more threat to Solomon's throne. So what happens next? Well, the next case is not a case of Solomon actually making sure that somebody dies. There is a veiled threat here, but he's going to exile somebody else. It's one of the priests. Verse 26 through 27 is the next section of this chapter. And we're told to Abiathar, the priest, King Solomon said this, "Go to Anathoth, to your estate," literally just to your field or to your land. "For you deserve death, but I will not at this time," notice that little caveat there, "I will not at this time put you to death, because you carried the ark of the Lord God before David my father, and because you shared in all my father's affliction." So Solomon expelled Abiathar. The Hebrew verb there is garash. That garash is what's used when God expelled or kicked out or exiled Adam and Eve from the garden, Genesis 3. Garash is also the verb used for when Cain was kicked out from hanging out with his family anymore. He was exiled, expelled. And it's the same verb that's often used in connection with the Exodus too, that the Israelites were kicked out of. They were exiled from the place of exile. They were garashed from the land of Egypt. They were expelled. So this is Solomon basically saying to Abiathar, you are now exiled from Jerusalem. You're exiled from the priesthood. You are going to go and live on your own land in Anathoth. That estate that you have there, estate's probably a little bit too fancy a word, but your land where you live, the land of your family, because you're not going to be a priest anymore. And we're told at the end of verse 27, this fulfilled the word of the Lord that he had spoken concerning the house of Eli at Shiloh. Now, that's a hearkening back to way early in the book of Samuel. I want to get to that just a second. Let me back up just a minute. So Abiathar has been with David's family for a long time.
Yeah.
We first met him back in, what was that chapter? 1 Samuel 22. So Abiathar is the guy that brought news to David when David was on the run from Saul, that Saul, by means of that evil guy Doeg, had killed all those priests. So Abiathar shows up and brings this bad news to David, and then he's with David all this time. Like Solomon even says, you know, you were the one who shared in all my father's afflictions. You were with him all this time, and you carry the ark of God. So why is he expelling him? Why is he exiling him? Because he is the one who was a supporter of Solomon's older brother Adonijah. And so he's perceived then to be someone who, I guess if not a threat, maybe someone who could at least undermine Solomon's authority should there be any kind of, you know, political upheaval in Jerusalem.
Yeah, well, this whole thing is very confusing as far as the way this reads now is if there were like two claims to the throne and people took sides and stuff like that. But that's not how it reads when you're actually reading the account. It just seems like one guy's presumptuous and that's it. It also seems, this is just us not knowing, but you know, if Joab or anyone else doesn't know that Solomon's supposed to be king, which we're not told that anyone knows that, you know, other than Bathsheba and Nathan, like doing their thing. Like we don't have any record of David saying that, obviously, and he might have, but was this, and maybe even if he did, was this common knowledge? Did all the sort of inside people know this? Because Solomon acts as though, hey, we had a usurper going on. There was someone that was trying to like get in on my position. It's very hard to tell exactly how this is playing out because you can see this priest being like, I just assumed like that was the way it was going to be. Like, I didn't know anything.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like I was pro Adonijah, anti Solomon.
Right. Yeah. I just thought that was the next guy.
I was like, well, it's the king's oldest son. So I assume he's going to be the next king. So it does seem way, Solomon seems hypersensitive about this and kind of overly threatened by everything going on. So much so that, you know, he's killing his brother. He's expelling this priest.
Well, and once David names Solomon king, it's not as though we have like these records of a bunch of people pushing back or anything. It just seems like this is
not at all
accepted by everyone.
It is weird.
It
seems an overreaction on my part on Solomon. Like he's going above and beyond anything necessary to ensure that there's going to be no possible threat whatsoever to his throne. But we're told that, you know, there's always kind of a mixture of human motives, which are always a mixed bag of good and bad, and then divine providence going on here. Because the divine providence part comes into the end of verse 27. So Solomon, he exiles Abiathar from being priest of the Lord. And then we're told this fulfilled the word of the Lord that he had spoken concerning the house of Eli in Shiloh. Now, what this is referring to is something that was prophesied way back in the second chapter of 1 Samuel. This is when you had Eli. You remember he was an old man. He had two sons who were corrupt priests. And we're told in 1 Samuel 2, 35 and 36, this prophecy that God will raise up for himself a faithful priest who will do according to what is in my heart and in my mind. I will build him a sure house. He shall go in and out before my anointed forever. And then it goes on to say, everybody who's left in your house, Eli, shall come to implore him for a piece of silver or a loaf of bread and shall say, please put me in one of the priest's places that I may eat a morsel of bread. So the prophecy is that in the future, God is going to take the priesthood from the house of Eli and is going to give it to another priestly family, put another priestly family in charge. And then this is fulfilled generations later in Solomon. this faithful priest that's going to be Zadok. He's going to be the one who replaces Abiathar. And this anointed that's referred to is Solomon. So this actually, we're going to see this multiple times. Kings, 1st, 2nd Kings, is very much concerned with the fulfillment of prophecy. And this is, we've already seen it somewhat when God promised David that a king, one of his seed, would sit on his throne. And lo and behold, it's fulfilled in Solomon, at least partially fulfilled in Solomon. Now, this prophecy back in 1 Samuel 2, 35 and 36 is being fulfilled when Abiathar is exiled and then Zadok takes his place. So, and we'll see more examples of this as we work our way along. So there's kind of this this understanding on the part of the author of Kings that many of the things that are happening are a fulfillment of what had been foretold earlier, like in 1st and 2nd Samuel.
Yeah, and we've talked about before, just because God gives a prophecy, God tells you something's going to happen, that doesn't mean that, therefore, Solomon's reaction is completely normal and correct. Doesn't mean that. Just means that God knew that this is how this was going to play out, and that this is a fulfillment of the word that he had spoken.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that's the case with all kinds of prophetic fulfillments, where you see that the people actually carrying out the fulfillment, probably more times than not, are acting in a terrible way. I mean, there was a lot of times when God said, hey, such and such is going to happen. And when it did, it was carried out by very violent, evil people.
Yeah.
I mean, we have that with the Babylonians, for instance. Just look at the crucifixion of Jesus. Mm-hmm. That was prophesied. Well, who carried it out? Well, a lot of very corrupt people carried it out. So it was the fulfillment of God's prophecy, but at the same time, it was fulfilled by the hands of sinful men. You always kind of have this mixed bag of, like I said earlier, these human motivations, many of which are sinful, and then the fulfillment of what God himself had foretold. So that's Adonijah, and then that is Abiathar. Both of those are taken care of. One is put to death, one is exiled. Next, we have our friend Joab. What's going to happen to him? When the news came to Joab, we're told, because Joab had supported Adonijah, although he had not supported Absalom, so it's a bit of a parenthetical comment about where Joab stood in relationship to earlier people who wanted the throne. So he had supported Adonijah. He had not supported Absalom. Obviously, he killed Absalom. He put him to death. When Joab heard this, he fled to the tent of the Lord and caught hold of the horns of the altar. So he's doing the same thing, of course, that Adonijah had done earlier. Probably thinking, well, it turned out pretty well for Adonijah at first, so maybe it'll turn out well for me as well.
He's like, I'll grab the horn. Like, if I can get the same thing Adonijah got, I can just not make a stupid request like he did, and I'll be all right.
Yeah, I won't ask for a girl, and I'll be fine. Well, things not going to turn out as well for him. So it was told to King Solomon what he had done, that he had fled to the tent of the Lord, and that he was beside the altar. Solomon says to Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and I've called Joab David's fixer, and we're about to see that Benaiah is going to be Solomon's fixer. He's the one who carries out all the dirty work of Solomon. Solomon sends Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, saying, go strike him down, period. Not go take him away from the altar, not, hey, go talk to him, not bring him to me, nothing. Just basically, go kill him. Well, Benaiah goes to the Lord's tent, and he doesn't do that right away. He doesn't carry out the explicit instructions of the king. Instead, he says to him, the king commands, come out. Well, that's not what the king commanded. The king said, go kill him. And when Benaiah gets there, he says, the king commanded, come out. No, he just said to kill you. So presumably what's happening here is Benaiah is a bit hesitant to go up to the very altar of God and to murder a man right there beside the Lord's altar.
So, and Benaiah has got to be a dude, knowing what kind of role he plays going forward. I mean, doesn't know who Joab is. I mean, if we don't know this, but Joab, like, you're talking about two guys that play a very similar role. This would seem like a difficult thing for him to go do right there at the older guy. Be like, I'm like killing just the older version of myself here.
Pretty much. Yeah. Because who Joab is exactly who Benaiah is going to become. And you know, he has some scruples. He doesn't want to carry out this act of bloodshed right there beside the holy altar of God.
Well, you're not supposed to do that when someone's like grabbing hold of the horns of the altar. Yeah, that's right. The whole point.
That's the whole point. Yeah, this was a place of asylum. So Joab responds, no. He says, I will die right here. I'm not moving. So Benaiah goes back to the king and he says, this is what Joab said. And the king replies to him, well, do what he said, strike him down and bury him. And then Solomon says this, this just kills me. Thus take away from me and from my father's house the guilt for the blood that Joab shed without cause. The Lord will bring back his bloody deeds on his own head, because without the knowledge of my father David, he attacked and killed with the sword two men more righteous and better than himself, Abner the son of Ner, commander of the army of Israel, and Amasa the son of Jether, commander of the army of Judah. So shall their blood come back on the head of Joab and on the head of his descendants forever. But for David and for his descendants and for his house and for his throne, there shall be peace from the Lord forevermore. So just to wrap up that section, Benaiah did it. He goes up, strikes down Joab, puts him to death. Joab is buried in his own house in the wilderness. And then Benaiah gets placed over the army in place of Joab. And then Zadok, the priest, is in place of Abiathar. Now, the reason this just kills me is because this is hypocrisy taken up to a whole new level.
Yeah, this is, so this you're is telling me wild that language.
This is such... This is perhaps, this ranks as one of the, in my opinion, one of the highest hypocritical statements in the entirety of the scriptures. So you're accusing Joab of shedding innocent blood.
Blood without cause. Well,
without cause, yeah. Well, how about taking a look at your dad,
yeah,
who threw Joab, who sent a letter, who penned a letter to Joab, the very person you're accusing of shedding innocent blood, penned a letter to Joab and said, hey, make sure that Uriah, who had done nothing wrong, absolutely nothing wrong, make sure that Uriah gets killed in battle.
Yeah, by the way, this innocent blood, innocent, I'm using air quotes here, innocent, like, that's up for debate.
It's very much up for debate.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's not, I asked Joab if he thought that was innocent blood. I don't think he agrees with that description.
No, because it would be fully in accord, actually with both of these deaths that Joab carried out, be fully in accord, at least culturally, to understand that Joab was within his rights to take out both of these guys. Now, maybe he did it in a very sneaky, sinister sort of way, but one of the guys had killed his brother, so he was the avenger of blood in taking out this guy that had killed his brother, and the other guy had been the general of Absalom's coup.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. Like, that guy's totally innocent. What are you talking about? Like, that's...
Yeah. So the whole without cause here is stretching that beyond imagination. So that's why this speech of Solomon seems to me just a complete act of self-justification. He's wanting to take out Joab because he perceived Joab to be a threat to him. And realistically, he probably was. Because, you know, Joab had a lot of power. We know that from that whole second half of 2 Samuel. But the way he justified this by saying, you know, well, Joab is guilty of innocent blood. Well, come on.
Basically, look at your own house. He tries to contrast the houses too. It's not just that he says he's guilty of innocent blood, so we got to take him out. Like, unlike the house, like, we got to rid my spotlessly clean house of this stain. Like, what in the world? we won't have to deal with just this horrible shedding of innocent blood, and we can just have peace reign forever in our house. I'm like, dude, God said specifically of your house that, like, the sword was, like, never going to depart from it because of how much bloodshed there was.
And keep in mind, too, that Solomon is whose son?
Yeah.
Bathsheba.
Yeah, it's not like he's
Bathsheba, that is the former widow of Uriah. Uriah being dead because David commanded Joab to make sure that he was dead on the battlefield. This was just a mess.
I know that you and I are partial to Joab. I think that we've come to that conclusion during this journey. And I do have to say, this feels like an extremely unfitting death for Joab.
Yeah, it is. You know, David wanted his gray hairs to go down to Sheol with blood on them, and that's what happened. But it does not seem to be an end that is befitting of Joab. But a man of violence, I guess he ended up dying a violent death. The best we can say is that at least they gave him a proper burial.
Yeah.
They made sure that he was buried in his own house in the wilderness. But not the end that I would have wanted for Joab.
No.
Certainly not with this kind of self-justifying actions and words on behalf of Solomon.
Yeah, and that's where we're going to leave it. We are well out of time. So Solomon has carried out the things that his father has requested him to do, at least some of them. But next week, we'll pick it up and we'll get into Solomon making one of his most famous requests. I wish you would have asked for this earlier.
Would have been good. Could have used some wisdom.
All right, Chad, I'll see you next week.
All right, see you then.